Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point in Shanghai. The city of Shanghai is home to 18 million people, Beijing 17 million, New York City a mere 8 million, and the high-rises in China keep going up. To put our finger on the pulse of big city life in China, we're turning to a woman who's been called China's Oprah. Hong Huang is a media mogul, Chinese super blogger, and wildly popular advice columnist. She listens to China. We'll listen to her. This hour, On Point, Life in the Big City, China Style, with media mogul Hong Huang. Joining me now from Beijing is Hong Huang, CEO of China Interactive Media Group. She's a media powerhouse. Her blog, Hong Huang is Looking for Fun, is one of the most popular in China. She's got a TV show. She starred in the 2005 movie Perpetual Motion. She published and sold Time Out Beijing and Time Out Shanghai. She launched 17 Magazine in China and publishes the high-gloss fashion magazine I Look. Her mother, a famous Chinese beauty and diplomat, was interpreter for Mao Zedong. Asia One and many others call Hong Huang the Oprah of China. Hong Huang, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you, too.
The Oprah of China. You spend time in the States. That's pretty big. That's amazing. Are you really that powerful?
I don't think I can actually fit into those shoes. I think that's rather, I'm totally, totally flattered. But those are huge shoes to be.
Those are pretty big shoes. But everywhere we turn, that's the label they've got right on you. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, maybe it'll take, there are actually maybe four women who basically can be categorized as such, and maybe it takes all four of us to fill one Oprah in the States.
Right. Well, you're our Oprah today, and we're really, really glad to have you with us. We want to look at life in the Chinese city. We've been spending the week in Shanghai, and we're blown away on many fronts. Lots of questions for you. Maybe we can just dive right in. I mean, you were educated in the States, went to college at Vassar years ago. You come from a big, sort of highly pedigreed Chinese political family. Stepfather was foreign minister of China. Your mom was there between Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong in 1972 doing the translating. But that means you went to the States, you got a big education there. When Americans look out at China today, just at the top level, Hong Huang, What do you sense that they get and don't get about China these days, and China, and life in China's big cities in particular?
I think what Americans get is that China is this growing economic power. And in some way, I think if you listen to American media and watch everything, it's something that people don't know what to think of yet. Either is it a friend? Is it a foe? Is it, you know, is it crushing us? Is it taking jobs away from the U.S.? Or is it giving us really nice cheap products in Walmart so that we can all buy, you know, things that we want at a lower price? You know, what is it? I think it's an enigma. What's the saying? Enigma wrapped in a puzzle or something like that?
Right,
I think that's
right. That's
what it is. And what is, I think, the oversight of China in terms of what the press coverage and the Western understanding of China is, everybody look at China and want to label it as a communist country. And everybody looks at focuses on the politics of it and the economics of it. But people have somehow overlooked the cultural part of it. You know, aside from the fact that we do dumplings, right?
Right, we heard.
You know, we do noodles, right? And things like that. And we know that you do chicken, right? So aside from these, there are lots of things that actually are very, very intrinsic in Chinese culture that actually is very influential in Chinese behavior, and not all of that behavior is terribly understood by Americans, and a lot of it is actually misunderstood.
You know,
for, yeah. Go ahead.
Being here in Shanghai, there may be plenty of room for misunderstanding, but in some ways it doesn't look all that enigmatic. I mean, it's very real. It's quite enormous. The energy is head spinning. And we want to get a sense with you of what's going on in the different tiers of the life that we're looking at here. I'm looking at Business Week talking about how China now has 106 billionaires, up from zero in 2002. And I am sure that there are a bunch of them within a couple of miles of me right now. At the bottom level, we've been out on the outskirts of Shanghai where migrant workers live and seen, you know, that this is the furthest thing from billionaires. People living in tiny little one-room places, pulling their water up from a well, no kitchen, no bathroom facilities. You know, really the bottom. People, I guess, who go into Chinese factories and so on. And then in the middle, you've got what gets called the middle class, and it seems to be all over the place. Let's start with the top. Your magazine seems to go kind of to the rich side. iLooks, I mean, this is really glossy, you know, sort of Vogue style magazine. When we look out at Shanghai and we try and understand, you know, the rich here, what's going on in rich Shanghai culturally?
I think, first of all, if you're in Shanghai, a lot of the rich Shanghainese are actually not Shanghainese. The rich Shanghai are also, actually, most of them are from Zhejiang province, which is the province, along with Fujian and Guangdong and Canton, are the three provinces that I think accounts for something like 65% of Chinese export of all sorts of things. I mean, they started with trinkets like Christmas ornaments, right, and so on and so forth. You really got to go travel in Zhejiang province to understand where this wealth creation came from and where all this money that is flooding Shanghai and all this wealth, it really comes from, if you go to this town called Wenzhou, which is very close to Shanghai, about maybe I think it's a 4 or 5 hour drive. Mm-hmm. You'll be proudly introduced by the Wenzhou government to an entrepreneur there and say, ah, meet Mr. Zhang. He produces 87% of all the ribbons that are produced in the world.
Right,
and you
right.
sort of say, wow, he's the ribbon
That's
man.
That's a lot of ribbon.
You know, if I ever want, yeah, right. if I ever want a ribbon. He goes, oh, and they have all these wonderful ways of describing it. They said, ah, you know, if you take all the ribbons he produced in a year and wrap it around the earth, you know.
Yeah, we go to Jupiter.
Or wrap around the moon, the moon right, will be as big as the earth or something like that. And then the next guy you meet, is, ah, this is Mr. Wang. He produces 100% of all the little wheels on the lighters on your, you know, those things that
and on and on, where, and those endless miles of factories and those endless miles of containers loaded up and ready to go out around the world.
Exactly, exactly. And so this is where really it's a very, very industrial manufacturer-based wealth that's in Shanghai. And when you go to, I'm sure you have been, where the rich shop, which is Plaza 66, where they have all the luxury brands from Europe and around the world.
And gleaming car dealerships, windows full of Bentleys for sale, and you name it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me tell you a funny story about Bentleys. There's a friend of mine who actually is one of a major buyer for one of the top luxury French luxury brands, and she bought wasn't a Bentley. It was one of those very, very long Cadillacs.
Okay. We can picture it.
And she
a stretch limo
somehow
from Cadillac,
really
yeah.
stretch limo, right? And she really likes my blog, so she reads it all the time. She says, "It's really great, you know. It's like I you're my type of woman." And somehow she sort of through friends and start writing to me. And when she found out I was going to Shanghai, she said, "I'm going to pick you up." And she came in her stretch limo, except she was driving it. Oh. And she couldn't make the turns. She couldn't make the corners at the airport because they were too tight. And so, you know, we ended up, you know, stuck at the airport trying to get the stretch limo, and neither one of us could possibly maneuver that thing out of it. So there's lots of, like, things that the I mean, basically, the money in China is very new, so it's basically nouveau riche, and we make these wonderful faux pas that probably make people laugh. But then on the other hand, it is, you know, a luxury manufacturer's dream market, right? Growing at 70% every year and so on.
At the high end, no question about it. They may make it down in the factory, but they spend it here, and there's evidence of that all over the place. And right next to it, I mean, you don't have to go far to get into those endless apartment towers, blocks, that look very middle class to me, and that just go on and on and on. It shoves right up against the heart of Shanghai. Clearly a big middle class growing here as well. Where do they make their money? Are they working in the administrative office of the big guy down at the factory?
Well, I think, you know, if you work for a prosperous and a Chinese company, like one of the companies that we mentioned before, you know, 85% of World Ribbon and whatnot, if you're like a middle-level management, you probably make something around 2,000 to 3,000 U.S., if not more. And you might have some, you know, bonuses coming to you that's in the realm of $20,000, $30,000 at the end of the year. So that's the middle class. That's actually the core of Shanghai. And so
in China, that's a pretty good income. I mean, you can do quite well on that.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, I mean, you know, considering that you can still buy a bowl of noodles for something like less than a dollar. So this is not bad. And the other part of Shanghai that is very middle class are the foreign company are Chinese who are working for foreign companies, American companies, European companies, mid-level management, and even in sort of junior level clerical type of work. You get paid.
Hold on,
if
you could stand by there in Beijing, we've got to take a short break here. We'll come right back. We're talking with, well, she's been called China's Oprah, Chinese media mogul Hong Huang, about big city life in China. Here's a saleswoman selling Versace perfume in Shanghai.
Mini香水一个，再加上我们Versace的存彩一支，那么多推广赠品，为的就是让您贴切的感受到我们Versace全新女士香氛所带出的独特魅力。
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point in Shanghai. We're talking this hour with Chinese media mogul, super blogger, and advice columnist Hong Huang about big city life in China today. She's been called China's Oprah. She's got magazines, TV show, movie credits to her name, and, well, you name it. She's everywhere. An advice column called Hong Huang is Looking for Fun, and maybe we'll find some of that in this hour. She joins us from Beijing, and we were just beginning to look at the urban middle class in China today, thinking about Shanghai in particular, where the apartment blocks go on and on and on and on and look pretty much like middle class apartments. To me, I mean, I'm looking in your magazines, Hong Huang, and they're at the top end, they're advertising vacations all over the place, Malaysia, the Maldives, Europe. But, you know, friends I'm talking with this week say that is now not just the province of the rich. You've got, you know, Chinese middle class getting
up, seeing
the world.
The middle class are traveling. We've seen that it's been a trend now for the past 2 years that when you ask Chinese what is the one thing that they consider as luxury, maybe 5-6 years ago, it was buying a house, buying a car. And now it has really gone from, you know, showing my status type of thing to actually experiencing something luxurious, like traveling. Mm-hmm. And so you have lots of Chinese who are traveling to Europe and going to America, and they really want to see the world, and they think that's something that is a way of rewarding themselves for working so hard.
Mm. Lots of Chinese going abroad for vacation or for education. Mm-hmm. I saw in your blog.
And also, the Chinese used to only know how to go on. They don't know how to go on vacation. They only know how to go on. They go on tours. You know, if they go to a place, if they go to Europe, it got to be place photo opportunities, you know, Eiffel Tower, Louvre.
Right.
You know, they got to have the monuments, and you got to snap that picture, and you got to rush back on the bus. And, you know, the more places I see, the better it is. Blah, blah, blah. And so this was the trend, like maybe 2 years ago or so. But now you see the middle class getting much more sophisticated. They want now real vacation. Now it's, you know, Club Med beach holidays, Club Med skiing resorts, you know, and winter sports, and they want to also go on these, you know, art and cultural sort of gourmet tours and driving tours of Europe. Yeah, so the concept
wine tasting
of,
in Napa Valley, you name it.
Totally, yeah.
I'm looking here at the chief economist of Goldman Sachs Asia saying that the middle class in China is growing much faster than the rise in the country's GDP. Now, we know the GDP is growing pretty fast, has been growing pretty fast in China for a long time. He's saying the middle class growing even faster than that. And I wanted to get your sense of what that means for Chinese society, you know, to go from a few decades ago where almost everyone was poor, to now 250 or 300 million middle class. How is that changing, let's say, in the cities to start with? How is it changing the social life, the interactions, not just the skyline, not just the housing, but what people do, how they live, how they think?
Well, I think the growth of the middle class is kind of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, in any country, I think, when you have a large middle class, it means stability. It means people who have mortgages to pay for their house and cars, and they're the least likely to actually, you know, go into a revolutionary mode and start up something or do something that would risk their life and possessions.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I've got this nasty cold these days.
We've heard about the air in Beijing.
Yeah. Well, you're now listening to it, the effects of the air in Beijing, that's for sure.
Sorry.
So on the other hand, I think the middle class are more sophisticated. They, aside from just living well and having their house, having their car, they're now, what you see is they're beginning to make demands on, for example, entertainment. For example, they're making demands on cultural products, you know, theaters. One of the latest things is that theaters, especially sort of avant-garde theaters, have been sold out. A friend of mine who is a playwright, he's a play director and his wife is a playwright. And the two of them have written a play for the past year called Opinion About Urban Life by Two Dogs. And they really, they've taken middle-class life, vignettes of middle-class life, and they put it on two dogs. And these are two dogs that are speaking to the audience. And it's only a two-actor thing. And they played something like over 460 times in last year alone, this one play. Yeah, so it was really well received in both Beijing and Shanghai. It's actually one of the first plays that played for, you know, more than every day in China. Because usually plays and even Broadway shows like Cats and these things that everybody thinks it's so extravagant and it should have a long running time actually doesn't. It's like, you know, maybe 20 shows and or 2 weeks and that's about it. But this small little, you know, avant-garde production was played 400 something times, more than 400 times. So it's amazing. And it obviously hit a chord on middle-class life. And it talks about, you know, infidelity. It talks about trying to make payment and trying to live up to the Joneses, trying to move upward, trying to abide by certain rules and regulations that they don't want to abide by, and all these middle-class dilemmas. It was very sort of classic in representing what a typical office worker, middle-class Chinese would feel in present-day society. And I think one of the things that people liked it so much is because it showed how much pressure they're under to actually keep their middle-class status and also to try to do better than your neighbor.
I was looking in the Shanghai Star this week. They've got an article about how the Shanghainese, at least, are mortgage slaves, they called them. It said in New York, people pay, on average, about 18 times their salary for an apartment. In Shanghai, it's something like 30 times their salary for a home, for an apartment. One of the highest, maybe the highest in the world. That's a lot of pressure. Mm. But let me ask you, yeah. You know, I wanted to ask because a few years ago, maybe a decade or more now, the talk in the West was always, well, you know, China is getting richer very quickly, and that will produce a middle class, and a middle class will produce pressure for more democracy. Do you see that mm-hmm. actually happening, or is it happening? Is it happening or not? Is it happening in a way we don't recognize? What do you think?
I'm not too optimistic about the Chinese middle class having actually a political conscience. Number one is they're very, very complacent about their current status because they have now done better than maybe their brothers and their parents. And so the status quo and doing well materially is probably the number one priority for Chinese middle class. And they're not the people who are going to really stick up for something and risk all the achievement. This is the part where I think Western culture and Chinese culture are not the same, in the fact that in America, you have this culture where you root for the underdog. You want justice, right? Mm-hmm. And all this righteousness that's really part of kind of the American dream and doing the right thing and all that. But in China, it's a very the Confucius thing. It's all about compromise. It's all about practicality. It's all about, you know, making things work for everybody and not disturbing the status quo. So the two cultures are very different in the way they approach problems in each society. And the middle class, not being the one, even in America, I think, who is going to be on the radical side of change, in China, is even more conservative. If you want to bring about, say, democracy, political change in China, I think the middle class might not be the group of people that you would look to actually to be the starters of something like that. You look at traditionally, it's always either students or intellectuals who are actually the ones who put forth ideas. Now, the middle class might follow, but they're not really, really, they're not going to be risking their current status quo for making changes.
So maybe it will come from another part of society or for lower in society. We've been talking with them, too, and I want to ask you about that. But before I do, I mean, as you describe that situation and characterize that kind of Confucian view of the world, I can't help but think about very recent Chinese history. And for that matter, you know, your mom, who Americans probably saw her on television with Richard Nixon when she was his interpreter. She was a diplomat. She was Mao Zedong's interpreter, taught him English, for heaven's sakes. And your dad, stepfather, foreign minister for China. So that means she was right in the middle of a time that where China was always talking about the underdog. Certainly the Little Red Book talks a lot about justice, you know, and I mean, talk about the status quo, and instead the message here was revolution. So I wonder what...
Well, Mao was a revolutionary. He was a middle class,
right.
That's for sure.
Right.
He didn't have mortgages to pay, that I'm sure.
No, but he turned a country upside down.
Mao did not have a mortgage.
No, he did not, but he had a pretty big house to live in by the end, and your mom spent time in those precincts.
Didn't he?
Yeah, no less than that. I know your mother has just passed away in the past few months, and I'm sorry for that.
Yeah. Thank you.
But what? You're welcome. But what did she think of the changes that she saw in China, having come out of revolutionary China, and in many ways the top of revolutionary China?
Yeah, I think you know, I was talking to someone the other day that in some ways I'm glad that my stepfather is not alive to see what is going on in China today, because for his generation of Chinese and for a lot of old cadres in China, it's very difficult to deal with the changes. Number one, their own status has completely disintegrated into they've been marginalized. They were at the center of power. Their vice were sought after. They were veteran revolutionaries. And now they're just marginalized old guys who are just basically taking walks in alleyways and complaining bitterly about how inflation and everything and people have no morals and the young ones only play video games and everything has become Americanized. So they are now truly, truly marginalized in China. They're no longer the mainstream. So in that sense, they had a belief system, which I think some of them did believe in communism. The others, I think, were less, I mean, they probably know of communism, and that's what they're supposed to believe in, but I doubt it if they actually studied what communism actually meant. But on the other hand, I think this generation of people are very disenchanted right now with the changes that's going on. They would be the ones who are seeing themselves in the position of the immigrant workers, the poor disenfranchised peasants who lost their land to real estate developers. They would side with those, and they would be the ones who are urging the government to take more measures and try to lessen the gap between the rich and the poor. And I think in the last 2 years, they've been heard. And I think the government is worried. If you look at the current sort of, you know, I mean, anytime in China, you have a sort of ongoing political campaign, right? And right now, it's harmonious society. And what does harmonious society mean? It means, you know, you're trying to level out the wealth differential between the rich and poor, and you're trying, I think it's a government way of trying to address some of the grievances of the underprivileged and also particularly a lot of old cadres who are very unhappy about being marginalized.
We're hearing
the modernization process.
We're hearing something about that new left this week, and it's interesting. And I want to look more at that bottom rung of urban life and life in general. But hey, we've also got to ask you, you're out there blocking all the time. You're pretty saucy, known in China as provocative, and kind of a Dear Abby column you've got, Ask Me, where people can ask you anything. What do people ask you, Oprah of China, Hong Wang?
Most of them is what people ask Oprah. I think that's where the kind of name got from. It's about emotional life. You know, it's like I have a boyfriend, he dumped me. And it's so amazing. One of the fascinating things that I've seen, which is actually worrisome, is that how much relationship has to do with money. It's just all the dilemmas has to do with, I love him, but he has no money. What am I going to do? I love her, but her parents don't think that I will be good enough. I will never make enough money to support her. Or my parents don't have as money as her parents. What do I do? Or, you know, my husband got a divorce and my husband and I are divorced and he refused to pay the alimony. What do I do? He's now married to a new wife and he's actually buying her jewelry. So I'm really upset. And what do I do? Can I sue them? Can I sue her? You know, it's money. It's a lot of emotional problems that's rooted in material.
Listen. And another, in status maybe, I saw one question on your blog. This was a question from a woman named Peach. And she said something like, you know, I've been educated overseas. Now I've got this boyfriend, but he's kind of unsophisticated. You know, he's not so cool. Should we get married? And you said, you know, basically you said, honey, I'm really worried about you to be that concerned with status and face. You said to her, do you think a donkey that's been abroad is better than a horse? In other words, you may have traveled, but don't be sure you're better.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of Chinese feel, you know, this whole thing about face, which is so important in China. Everybody, it's all about that. If you've been abroad, you come back, women have to find a man that is have, you know, if the woman has a master's degree, she should at least find a guy with a doctorate, for God's sake, you know. And if you just find a guy with a college degree, oh, my God, how embarrassing. You marry just a college graduate while you are a master degree student?
Hong Huang in Beijing, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking with Chinese media mogul Hong Huang. Here's sounds from a labor market in Shanghai. Migrant workers looking for work. It's a slow day. They say they'll just eat porridge today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Chinese media mogul, big-time blogger, and advice columnist Hong Huang about life in the big city in China today. She's been called the Oprah Winfrey of China, American-educated. Her mother was a very prominent diplomat, interpreter for Mao Zedong and Richard Nixon. She's in the thick of Chinese life today, giving all kinds of advice, putting out magazines. She's on TV. She's in film. Here she is from the film Perpetual Motion. You'll hear a little English voice over here. She's playing a character called Nunu, a 40-something, well-to-do woman. She invites three friends over to find out which one is having an affair with her husband. Singer Liu Sola plays the bisexual character here, Lala. In this scene, Lala offers Nunu a lot of comfort, maybe.
Have you ever stolen someone's husband? Does a husband really have to be stolen? Don't husbands make their way to me by themselves?
Did you just sleep with my husband?
Why would I have to sleep with your husband? I did him a long time ago.
Hong Huang in the movies in Perpetual Motion in 2005. Okay. We've got...
What a dialogue.
Yeah, well... You know, but there you are. You've got kind of a reputation in China for talking about matters sexual. Is that realm of life changing as well? Is your film an indicator?
Well, I think that the fact that I'm even popular in China has something to do with the fact that I actually dare to discuss these things. I think I stumbled upon it not because it was well planned or intentional that I will become, you know, discuss these things. But, you know, you have so many Chinese women who are so confused about their sexuality, their emotional problems, and, you know, what is modern, what is conservative, what is right, what is wrong. And the thing is, when you meet them, they're all so pretty. They're all so beautiful, and they're all so proper, despite whatever it is that's boiling, you know, as a beneath. All that, they keep up such a great facade at pretending that nothing is wrong. And that must be, like, completely... I mean, just imagine the pressure of that. For example, I know this woman who is married to a... Actually, all this started, especially the blog started, with a friend of mine who is married to an art critic. And he is... a renowned playboy. She's caught him in bed with her best friend, other female artists, and so on and so forth. But she stayed in the marriage, right? And so whenever I have dinner with her, and you can have dinner with her four times a week, and the subject never changes, it's like, should I divorce him? That's the first year. The second year is, I'm not going to divorce him, but I've only slept with him. Was my life in vain? You know, maybe I should sleep with other guys. Should I have an affair? You know, this goes on. And I just watched her go over this for 3 years, went from, should I leave him because he's having an affair, to should I have an affair on my own, to should I agree to the fact that he demanded a threesome. You know, it just never ends. It's sort of like, and then meanwhile, you know, when she gets her fair share of interviews from Chinese media as well, and that's how I know her, she's like, oh yes, we love each other, we support each other in our work. And you look at her and you say, this cannot possibly be the woman that last night was crying on my shoulders and saying, you know, should she have an affair or should she leave her husband because he's demanding a threesome with her best friend or something like that. You know, the kind of things they have to deal with, you feel like are so antiquated almost. You know, it's like American women or Western women had dealt with it probably 50 to 100 years ago with things like this. Or at least, you know, 30, 20 years ago when during the women's movement.
Why are these new issues in China now? Why weren't they dealt with in China 20, 30, 50 years ago?
Well, I think the Chinese government actually became like a sugar daddy to Chinese women. They handed Chinese women every single right that a Western woman had to fight for, like equal pay, voting rights, and all these things. So in some ways, and they pushed them out of the household and said, you got to work because, you know, we're a communist state and we believe that women holds up half the sky, so you got to go earn your share. And so all that political sort of grandstanding for women's rights actually ruined in some way, their own self-consciousness to fight for their rights. You know, they take it a little bit for granted. So now that the state is no longer doing that, you know, you don't have to work. If your husband is making great money, then you can stay at home. I mean, I know a girl who is a Harvard graduate who's living in a house, a gorgeous house, with a husband and three concubines because she decided that even though she has a Harvard degree, she really likes what her husband can provide for her. She, in order to make sure that he doesn't leave her and actually go off with another woman, she has actually agreed for him to take in two or three other wives. I mean, this is going back to feudal time in China. You know,
I mean they talk about old-fashioned. That's like 1,000 years ago in China.
Yeah, it's not actually 1,000 years ago. My grandfather had three wives.
Oh, well, 1,000 and more recently, but not like
100
not like
years
50.
Ago.
Right.
Yeah, 100 years
maybe
ago.
Maybe both. That's amazing.
So, yeah. So that's
is that
like,
where China's headed? A super rich Confucian state recreating the China of, I don't know, the feudal period?
Well, yeah, then I have to leave, don't I? So I hope not, but there's definitely very, very clear signals of that kind of thinking, you know. And I used to get hate mail from Chinese men. And when I went on the book tour, God, there would be people, there would be like men who would come up very close to the stand and say, I will never allow you to speak to my wife. Because you'll contaminate her.
You'll make her a free thinker.
Yeah, exactly. I looked at him and I was just like, God, you know, good luck for getting a wife, given the way you are. But, you know, so, I mean, it's this kind of thing that if you talk to men like that, everybody, like the newspaper can make a monster of you, you know. And so in some ways, most Chinese, so I asked them, I said, as a Chinese woman, how would you say I should take a statement like that? Mm-hmm. And like most Chinese, like the male journalists would say to me, well, you should say something like, I would love to meet your wife, but I hope you approve of me someday because I can, you know, so I'm like, you know, but why would you want to do that? You know, why are we playing this game? But this is something that in terms of identity, the Chinese have been lying to themselves, I think, for a long time now.
If we could, I'd like to move from the sexual, maybe marital, to, if you can talk about it in China today, the spiritual. We happened just to be driving down Big Boulevard in Shanghai over the weekend. It was Sunday morning, and we came upon a big church there. It's called the Community Church. As we just and there was a huge crowd outside, you know, pushing in, and so we just went in with them. My goodness, I mean, it was an overflow crowd. Every pew filled to bursting, and then an enormous garden, which was full of Chinese congregants sitting in little chairs, you know, shoulder to shoulder out in the garden, listening to the music and the prayer being piped out on a microphone. Now that's just Christian. I know that's a minority in China, but what about the spiritual life, the spiritual seeking you see in China today?
Well, you know, actually, you know, remember we talked about whether the middle class can actually bring about democracy in China? This is probably one area where the middle class are actually involved in, is now that their material life are more or less satisfied, they have an overwhelming desire to actually have a spiritual life. And you can see them more active. I mean, I don't know, but I've been to sort of these gatherings and at churches, and you see a lot more younger people. It's not like if you go to churches in the States, you see like only very senior citizens. But
well, that depends where you're going, but okay.
Okay, but you know, in China, you have a lot of sort of young middle class people getting, you know, involved with religion and getting involved, trying to learn something about a faith or a spiritual life and things like that. So I think that's another interesting development that has taken place during the past couple of years. And I really think that, you know, the Chinese will lean towards but there are a couple of things one has to be completely aware of. One is that China never had a state religion in its history for, 4,000, 5,000 years. It wasn't sort of, it never really lived with a state religion, even though Buddhism at some times was very predominant in China. That's one thing. So the spiritual life of China has always been something that's lacking, and for better or for worse, the Chinese are used to not having as much as a spiritual life as, say, Indians, for example. So from that side, it's something that the Chinese populace can deal with. They don't feel as deprived as other people. That's number one. Number two is the government's current stand about spirituality and religion in China, obviously, is also extremely conservative and still pretty much would conform to some of the ideas that Western media would have of communist countries, for example. And so from that aspect of it, these two tend to have limited the amount of faith and spiritual life that goes on in China. But I think that is going to be developing as the demand for a spiritual life will be driven by the middle class more than anybody else.
Speak to us then. We've looked at billionaires. We've looked at the middle class. Let's talk about the poor. I mentioned earlier we were out in a migrant worker community on the edge of Shanghai. I mean, these were not mud huts, but these were very, very humble dwellings. These were really poor people, who, I guess, must work in factories or as nannies, housekeepers, little tiny rooms and pretty raggedy conditions. They are not part of the boom. They've made their way to Shanghai, as migrants have made their way to many cities. What role do they play in the Chinese city today? And bigger than that, if you look at the poor on across China, where is their voice in this whole big picture, a long way from the Bentleys and the skyscrapers?
Well, first of all, as far as, you know, Chinese cities are concerned, they built them. You know, if you look at the skyscrapers,
they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And it is the migrant workers who made the most unbelievable human sacrifice to make these things built. Okay, so they were in the city making a living, but the kind of living condition that they themselves have to endure is incredibly, incredibly impoverished. So I think having made their contribution to building these cities, and also for the peasants for the farmers who have given up land or land were taken away from them for real estate development, they're the ones who are left on the bottom of the barrel. I think right now there are lots of movements and callings and sort of campaigns to raise money to help the poor and, you know, have a great heart, what they call generosity, 爱心, you know, a heart of love and so on and so forth. But ultimately, I think what it needs to do is to realize that in a republic, in a democratic republic, if you're a citizen, you have certain social responsibilities. And helping the poor is part of the responsibility of every citizen and also the government. And so I think for the Chinese government, it's a huge challenge to actually work out a program to help these people.
But China's not a democratic republic, at least in the sense that most Americans would understand it by any means. So does it feel that responsibility?
I think it does feel that responsibility. I think it probably feels more so because ultimately, if you talk about instability and what is going to lead to either riots or any kind of instability in urban cities, it would be the poor. It wouldn't be the middle class, right? Mm-hmm. So I think for aside from the fact that there is a social responsibility and so on and so forth, and all the glorified causes that you're supposed to do that, there's also a genuine fear of the fact that the inequality will bring social instability in China.
And so maybe they're prompted to work something, to work on something on that front. We've just got you for another minute or two. We've been looking at the cities, but you know, the big global picture is so so urgent a lot of times these days. You've seen everything in the press in the last month or so, all the friction around political issues in China and so on. You know the United States very well. You went to high school, I think, in Manhattan. You went to Vassar. We can hear it in your voice. Where do you think these two countries are headed? Is this going to work out? Can they share this little planet of ours?
I don't think we have any choice but to work it out, because it's too big a conflict for the world. I mean, you know, there is, when you talk about global issues, the issues that Americans have with China are environmental, human rights. If you go look at sort of people in Wenzhou, for example, where the bosses are rich, the factory towns, who are the buyers? They're all the major chain supermarkets in the States, or the big brands in the States. And if you talk to the people who are in these towns, it's a major conflict, because every year the buyer from the U.S. want to buy the product for 10% lower price. In the meantime, the Chinese government, under international pressure, is putting up environmental laws and human labor laws and so on and so forth. So you have a rising cost but lowering purchasing price. And so this is something that they're confronting with, and it's a dilemma for Chinese entrepreneurs. And unless it's worked out, you're going to have a lot of unhappy people, not only in China, but I think pretty much around the world.
Hong Huang, you're awesome. You and Oprah ought to swap microphones, swap televisions sometime. Come over to the States and do it. Have her come over here. We're really grateful to you for being with us from Beijing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook in Shanghai. Thanks for being with us. This is On Point.